All right. First and only case we have up this morning is docket number 77312. Counsel, are we ready to proceed? All right, why don't you come on up? And Justice Kadish is joining us from Las Vegas today.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Stephen Kent for appellant. Your Honor, it's often said that 90% of life is just showing up. In this case, it's an issue of the defendant not showing up to apply that the patient requested nursing assistance for to get to the bathroom. Common sense, as well as an examination of defendant's own nurse, establishes that that is not medical judgment, medical treatment, or medical diagnosis. It's simply routine care. The majority of the cases that have considered that issue have reached that conclusion. And the district court erred in getting off on a sidetrack created by the respondent about whether or not fall risk assessment and compression devices on her legs were medical treatment. None of that occurred when the fall occurred. And our theory and our claim is just that the defendant did not respond to a call light so that our client could get to the bathroom. And because of that, out of necessity, she was trying to get to the bathroom, and that failure to respond or not showing up is not exercising medical judgment, medical treatment, or medical care. No one was in the room at the time that that occurred.
Counsel, if I could interrupt, and there's a little bit of a delay, so we'll try to work this out. But my question is, how long did she wait after pushing the call light before she tried to get up, and how long is too long?
Her son testified that she told him that she pushed the call light 5 times, and
right.
Then out of necessity she had to get up. So that's
right, but we don't know how long she waited, correct?
We don't know that, Your Honor. I assume from the fact that she pushed the call light 5 times, it was a substantial time period. I think that's a reasonable inference from that evidence.
Well, how long should it take for a nurse to respond? Isn't that something that depends on the nature of the patient and the other demands on the nursing staff?
That argument fails, Your Honor. That's respondent's argument. Because the respondent offered no evidence that there was an emergency, that they were overstaffed, and it's the respondent's obligation to prove that, if that's their theory, and they offered nothing. In fact, the nurse...
Well, isn't it your obligation to prove, I mean, if it's a negligence claim, as you say, then what's the standard of reasonableness?
We don't have, you know, our argument is that they didn't show up at all. Our argument is not they didn't show up quick enough. They never came at all. So it's the response.
Right, we don't know if it was 2 minutes after the buzz or 20 minutes or an hour.
Well, I think we know it was not an hour, Your Honor. The testimony was 5 attempts to call the nurse with the call light, and then she got out of bed. So I think that establishes a substantial amount of time of her waiting and no one showing up. If it is, as respondent claims, they were exercising some medical judgment because there was an emergency or there were other things that had to be done on the floor, they've got to offer some evidence to support that, and there is nothing. There is no evidence at all that any medical judgment, diagnosis, or treatment was related to this decision of not showing up.
Well, isn't it a little broader than that? I mean, the whole issue here is centered around whether or not this is negligence or medical malpractice.
Right.
And this treatment, she came in, and I guess she was hypoglycemic and weak and dizzy, and she was a fall risk. They assessed her immediately as they brought her in, and they took certain precautions related to that assessment. And part of it were the compression devices and other measures. And so tell me why what they were doing wasn't part and parcel for medical treatment. And I understand what you're saying. You know, there might have been a delay in the time that she buzzed and somebody came in to see her, but it seems like she tripped on her compression devices, which was part of that treatment.
What the court has to do, and I think that question raises the correct issue, and that is when you have someone in the hospital, if there are things that are occurring that are ordinary negligence, are those claims allowed to pursue when there may be other treatment that is obviously medical malpractice? And that's going to happen in every case. So Gladys Turner goes into the hospital. She has all kinds of assessments, treatment, diagnosis, medical judgment. But the conclusion has to be that even though there was medical judgment on a billion things going on with her, was there medical judgment related to the failure to show up for this simple act of not responding to a call light to help someone to the bathroom? If you use your question in your argument, everything is always going to be medical negligence. And that, of course, was the respondent's argument in the hearing. You know, we did assessments, we had the compression devices, and this is all part of a plan for treatment of a patient, and therefore it's all medical judgment, diagnosis, and treatment. That's not reality. In a hospital, there are certainly medical judgment, diagnosis, and treatment, but there's also things that occur like mopping the floor, changing the bed linens, helping someone to the bathroom that are not medical care, treatment, and judgment. So the question is, when there are these medical care, treatment, and judgment that are related to the patient, does that preclude the patient from making a simple negligence claim when it was just an act of not showing up? And it's not
a delay. And that goes to part and parcel of, let me ask you a question. That's part and parcel of the real question. Which is, she fell. She was a falling risk, and that's why she was in there. They were trying to determine what the underlying nature of the condition was. And a lot of your cases that you cited supporting your position were negligence-based. You leave a substance on the floor, you don't clean it up properly, and the patient slips in that substance, as opposed to here, where she was being actively treated for a condition and knowing full well she was a fall risk. And they took those precautions. And so the question becomes, you know, is it necessary to have expert testimony to assist the jury in making this determination? So if you would address that.
That when you read the cases, that's one factor, whether or not expert testimony is necessary. And I think that's one of the factors that the district court relied on. But again, you have a situation in any hospital admission where a patient comes in and that patient is assessed and they're evaluated and then they're placed into a room. And if you're going to conclude that is all medical treatment, judgment, and diagnosis, then there's never going to be any general negligence. And that, of course, was the defendant's argument. But that's the question. And the answer is that still, within that context, things like not showing up at all, not sweeping the floor, changing the bed linens, those things are not professional negligence. They are general negligence. And even though there were professional judgment and diagnosis related to that patient, that doesn't mean that everything that happened is professional negligence. There still may be general negligence, and that's what occurred here. And the court, if you look at those cases, I believe they're clear in concluding that the simple act of not showing up to a call light to help a patient to the bathroom is not professional negligence.
Mr. Kent, I have a slightly different question now. When I saw this case, I too was intrigued by your argument, but then I read the complaint and the attached affidavit from Nurse McDonald.
Right.
And what struck me was your expert nurse cast this claim in the context of medical negligence or standard of care, is what I prefer to use here. In fact, in paragraph 4 of the affidavit, she identifies that the nurses and employees of Renown were fell below the standard of care and the prevailing professional practices, and then she articulates failing to assess, score, and document the high risk for falls, and then also says a failure to follow hospital policy and nationally recognized practice. And then in 5, she says the above breaches of accepted standard of care caused or contributed to the timely response to the call light. So your expert in the attachment to the complaint is characterizing this matter as an exercise of medical judgment. Why shouldn't we accept the way you characterize it? Now, I applaud you. You're a very, very proficient practitioner for attaching an affidavit on a potentially medical malpractice case. We all know the consequence of not doing so. But it seems like the complaint and your affidavit is casting this claim in the context of the exercise of medical judgment. And it is something more involved than simply not responding to a call light. Could you comment on this?
Sure. Ms. McDonald did not say that there was not medical negligence. She did not address that topic. She did not testify in the hearing, and the court admitted her report without any testimony, which I think was error. But it goes back to a plaintiff can plead alternative theories, and certainly a competent practitioner would plead both specific professional negligence and general negligence. And it goes back to my comment to Chief Justice that there can be, in a circumstance, professional negligence and general negligence. The question is the act general negligence?
You're familiar with the case that we decided up in Humboldt County, where we made the point that sometimes there are separations. That was in the context of a tort versus a medical negligence case. And really what the courts are being asked to do is assess what is the gravamen of the case.
Right.
And it seems like even your expert is characterizing the gravamen of this problem to be one of medical judgment and a breach of the standard of care.
But not exclusively. Her report did not say exclusively, and that was never addressed by her. So
the affidavit that's attached does not, to the complaint,
right,
does not express in an alternative, if you will,
right,
a negligence claim or a negligence cause. So that's what's concerning me.
Right. Well, She was never called as a witness. Her report came in. The report, I don't believe, even close characterized, it says all of the claims are professional negligence. She just did not address that. So I think when it goes back to that issue again, when there are factual circumstances, the court has to analyze the factual circumstances. Should a claim be precluded because of the way it was pled in the complaint, or should we look at the facts of the case? I think we should look at the facts of the case, which are, you know, and what if a claimant has a professional negligence claim and has a general negligence claim? Shouldn't the general negligence claim be allowed to proceed if it's tied to facts that are general negligence facts, which is a failure to show up, which is general negligence, not professional negligence? So even though, you know, we had the affidavit, and there certainly, if the statute hadn't expired, there would be professional negligence claims, does that mean that general negligence claims should be precluded? I think the answer is clearly no. As long as there's a general negligence claim that it stands on its own 2 feet, which this one does because of the facts relating to failure to respond, then that claim should be allowed to go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Kent. I didn't ask you if you were going to reserve any time for rebuttal, and we did question you quite a bit, so I'm going to give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll give opposing counsel an additional 2 minutes as well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Adam Hosmer-Henner, Don Toronto, on behalf of respondents for NAPHealth and NAMutual Medical Services.
Mr. Hosmer-Henner, because I'm by video, I need you to try to speak toward the mic. Now, it looks like you're a little bit taller than I am, certainly, so you're going to have to project a little bit to reach that.
Well, the video screen makes you look much taller, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Can you hear, is this okay now? Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you now. Thank you.
This is a medical malpractice case. The gravamen of each of appellant's causes of action sounds unmistakably in medical malpractice. There are certainly claims involving hospitals, such as slipping on a loose tile or a fall due to a foreign substance, that sound in ordinary negligence. There are even situations and fact patterns that we can imagine where a claim can be based, where multiple claims can sound in ordinary negligence and others can sound in medical malpractice.
Let me ask you this. So you can parse out these claims. You're saying there are medical negligence claims and general negligence claims that pertain to loose tiles and foreign substances. How do you distinguish this?
This court answered that question in Szymborski, Your Honor, and said specifically that the court's obligation is to determine on a case-by-case basis whether the claims sound in medical malpractice or ordinary negligence. And to do that is to determine whether that claim, the gravamen of the claim, not the facial characterization of the claim, but the substantial point or essence, is based in medical judgment, diagnosis, treatment. And the way that's been done in both the Szymborski decision and in the Lewis decision, unpublished before this court and throughout this country, is to determine whether the gravamen of the case relates to the medical provider's provision of medical treatment, the use of their skill or judgment, the exercise of their discretion, the use of their training, and specifically in the Szymborski decision, whether expert testimony is required to establish the standard of care. And I'd like to jump straight to that and to Justice Kadish's question about how long is too long. If this is an ordinary negligence case, what is the standard for time to respond to the call light? According to the record, and I'll refer this court to APP 665, Mr. Turner testified, and this is a hearsay statement, but it was considered by the district court for the purposes of his analysis, that the time that it took between Ms. Turner, when she first activated the call light, and when she tried to get out of bed by herself, was approximately 5 to 10 minutes. Did that breach the standard of care? The only way to assess that is by looking at the expert testimony that not only came in from Ms. McDonald's affidavit, but in the testimony of the other experts in this case. Ms. McDonald testified unmistakably that the failure to respond to a call light fell below nationally recognized standards for hospitals in terms of their safety policies and protocols. That statement was then adopted by appellants through the verification of their complaint and adopted during trial testimony as a statement that they agreed with. Dr. Dow, appellant's own expert, then adopted that statement and agreed with the conclusions of Ms. McDonald. Furthermore, Dr. Dow testified, and Dr. Dow's testimony is kind of a separate matter, but what he did specifically testify was that in his experience, limited though it may be, his experience was the policy and standard for responding to a call light in a hospital was 2 minutes. Renowned expert, Ms. Leary, testified that while it depends on a lot of circumstances, the triaging of the nurse, the busyness of the hospital at that time, the nature of the patient, the accepted standard of care generally in her experience was 3 minutes. Without that expert testimony, it's impossible to make an ordinary negligence claim in this circumstance because the standard of care is established through the medical discretion, judgment, and training of the hospital, including their specific policies. Ms. Turner was assessed for fall risk from the moment she entered the hospital. She was admitted with hypoglycemia, confusion, and general malaise. She was assessed and diagnosed as a fall risk according to a multi-point checklist by a physician. After being assessed as a fall risk, that physician then entered an order in accordance with Renown's fall risk policy and prescribed a bevy of fall risk precautions. These included the use of a bed alarm, the use of treaded slippers, placing her bed in a low and locked position, hourly rounding, referring to the frequency with which Ms. Turner was going to be checked on. It included informational signs to alert staff and visitors that she was a fall risk. And specifically for this case, it included the placement of a call light within easy reach of Ms. Turner. She was instructed specifically not to try to get out of bed by herself, not to try to ambulate to the bathroom without assistance. That call light system only exists within the hospital setting, and it exists as part of Renown's fall risk protocol and fall risk precautions to reduce the chances that a patient will fall while they're in the care of the hospital. There's testimony that Renown objected to on the basis of hearsay, that it took approximately 5 to 10 minutes for Ms. Turner, after using the call light, to then try to get out of bed by herself, activating the bed alarm. That time period can only be assessed in the context of the fall risk policy and the precautions that Renown put in place. And this was adopted throughout the testimony of every expert that testified in this case, from Ms. Leary to Mr. Dow to Ms. McDonald's expert. The question is not whether you can plead alternative theories. The question is whether those alternative theories still sound in the same operative set of facts. And those claims are based on the same gravamen, the same substantial point in essence. And here they are. The contemporaneous evidence of why Ms. Turner fell included her own statement as recorded in the medical records that she tried to get out of bed to go to the bathroom, but her feet were tied. Her feet were tied because Renown had employed, consistent with their fall risk protocol, sequential compression devices. Those are medical devices that are attached to the legs that have been established through the literature that we introduced through Ms. Leary and Dr. Dow as potentially increasing the fall risk of a patient. Those devices, despite that potentially elevated fall risk, are used in order to prevent an even more serious condition of thrombosis or blood clotting. And the medical doctors at Renown and the nurses who applied them made the decision to employ those SCDs rather than forms of chemical treatment to reduce blood clotting, such as Coumadin or other sort of pharmacological treatments, in order to prevent Ms. Turner from developing a serious condition, deep vein thrombosis, or a thromboembolism. That decision is soundly committed to the medical discretion of the renowned treating providers, even though it posed a potentially increased fall risk. Because of that, as Justice Perigari asked, this case involves something more broadly than just responding to a call light. It involves the whole treatment by a hospital of a patient who is a fall risk. And that slate of treatment precautions includes the use of SCDs because someone who cannot ambulate as well as another patient requires those in order to prevent blood clotting. And that means that the failure to respond to a call light, just as this court held in Lewis when a patient was under a monitoring order, and the court determined that the failure to check on them as frequently pursuant to that monitoring order still constituted medical treatment, diagnosis, or judgment. Here, Ms. Turner was under a fall risk protocol that required hourly rounding. And if that was insufficient, given the nature of her medical conditions, then that can still only be assessed through the use of medical expert testimony to determine what the appropriate standard of care would have been for someone like Ms. Turner.
So, counsel, if plaintiff, I know that they had sought to amend their complaint. Ultimately, Judge Hardy delayed ruling on that pending the evidentiary hearing that resulted in the judgment entered in the district court. But if the plaintiff wants to or does narrow their claim to just asserted negligence in not responding to the call light, in other words, if they don't argue negligence in applying these SCDs to her legs, if they only can argue negligence in not responding to the call light, could that be ordinary negligence rather than professional negligence?
It cannot, Your Honor. And the reason is because the same operative facts and the same gravamen are still at issue. The proposed amendment to the complaint did nothing other than delete the affidavit of Ms. McDonald. It removed the references to medical malpractice, and it made minor other changes to the complaint. But the same causes of action were still there based on the same set of operative facts.
So let me test this response, if I may. Is it foreseeable that a patient who is undergoing the fall risk protocol will nevertheless get up and try to go to the restroom, as this patient did, and in doing so is going to have these, SCRs or whatever the acronym is, attached to her or his legs that would actually increase the risk of a fall. Isn't that foreseeable?
Your Honor, for the sake of that hypothetical, I would agree that that's a foreseeable risk that a patient would disregard the orders of the physicians and try to get out of bed, even forgetting potentially that the SCDs were attached. And what I would argue is that there are additional restraints that could be used in those circumstances if it was foreseeable, and those are up to a medical determination by the treating providers. Renown's expert, Ms. Leary, testified explicitly to that when she said that the fall risk precautions employed by Renown were neither the least restrictive nor the most restrictive that could have been employed. And there are additional measures to prevent falls, including actually physically restraining the patient to the bed when they're a danger to themselves or others, or placing all four bed rails up in a raised position so that the patient cannot get out of bed by themselves without posing additional risk. And she specifically testified that those measures in her medical judgment were not indicated for Ms. Turner, who is alert and oriented. And when a patient is alert and oriented, the medical standard of care is not to employ those higher, more severe, and more restrictive restraints.
So that caused me to think about the use of the call light or the role the call light and its response would play in this case, and raises a question in my mind about whether this is a case involving the exercise of medical judgment or simple negligence. If you have an alert patient who is a fall risk, has these devices on her legs, and the hospital does not respond within a 3-minute period, and you accept the hearsay testimony that it's beyond that period of time, it's not very surprising to me that a patient would say, I'm getting up and going, I gotta go. That doesn't surprise me at all, and I'm not sure that consequence is the product of medical judgment. That's just human life and whether or not there's negligence. Now, it might very well be that there's an enormous defense to that. The patient has created their own risk of harm, and it becomes something that is the subject of a defense to any negligence claim. But that's something that is for the trier of fact, not something for a motion to dismiss. So to Justice Kiddish's earlier point, if the claim that's being made here, now it's not articulated in the current complaint, with all due respect to Mr. Kent, what I've just articulated is not the theory of liability expressed by the complaint or the theory of liability expressed by the Ms. McDonald's affidavit. But if allowed to amend and pursue that, why can't they make a negligence claim? You responded too late to the call light, the patient became impatient and got up and fell, and that's a foreseeable consequence and doesn't involve medical judgment. What's wrong with that theory? And why shouldn't the plaintiff be allowed to amend the complaint to state it?
Well, first, I believe that would be an amendment not based on facts in the record or in good faith, because that's not the case that's really presented here. But I mm-hmm. think Your Honor presents a different case than the one we have. But I still believe that both sound within medical, apologize, Justice Kadish, both sound within medical malpractice. And the reason is because you have to look at the standard of care in both cases. In one case, the foreseeability is that a patient who is alert and oriented, who is being somewhat restrained with SCDs, it poses a fall risk based on the medical evaluation of that patient and what that fall risk is. And if the hospital fails to employ the more extreme measures that it could, such as those enhanced restraints, or a sitter or someone watching them at all times based on the medical judgment that that person is a severe fall risk, then that still implicates medical judgment because the hospital's chosen not to employ the lower standard of restraints.
Well, I thought the medical judgment you were talking about was the medical judgment involved in the response time that's appropriate. And I get that. I mean, hospitals are busy places. Nurses are very busy people. So there must be some standard of care associated with the response time. But here, there's at least a question that's been raised about whether the response time was too late. So I don't know whether Mr. Kent asked the judge to let me amend the complaint, to restate the complaint along the theory that I have outlined. I don't see that, but assuming he had, it would seem like it would raise a different question.
That complaint also raises a different set of facts because the facts are about the time to respond to a call light of a patient who is in a fall risk protocol. So in the first instance, that wasn't the amendment that was proposed. Mm-hmm. In the second, I don't believe that issue has been preserved for appeal and would affect the judgment of this court in this case. But the call light, Your Honor, is a part of the fall risk protocol, and the decision to respond and the time to respond to that call light is implicated by the medical policies and judgment of the treating providers. And the reason is because the call light may be used for non-medical services. It may be used for something that the patient incorrectly believes is a medical emergency, but there's a veil of ignorance between the nurse and the responding practitioner and the person in the room. And while that event could be as serious as someone going to cardiac arrest and hitting the call like frantically calling for attention, it could be someone needing to go to the bathroom and who's at fall risk. It could be someone wanting something for a device, you know, or to change the TV channel on a non-medical service. But the point is that the nurse and the medical providers that can only answer that call light are confined to their medical discretion by their knowledge of the patient, how quickly they should respond to that. It's important that in the record it's undisputed that only people with medical training can respond to that call light. Only a nurse or someone with similar licensure can respond to a call light and deactivate it. And because of that, it's clear that the hospital policy is to treat the call light as part of the medical treatment provided to patients because they're unaware of what lies on the other side of the door. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
You've identified the problem, or the question, and that is, why can't the plaintiff amend to just state a simple negligence claim? And that's what we attempted to do. We filed an amended complaint, and our only allegation was the defendant failed to respond to the call light at all. That was our only claim. We did not adopt McDonald in the hearing. She wasn't even a witness. And our theory was just that this failure to respond at all is simple negligence that a jury can decide without an expert. And that's the issue. In the context of a hospital admission, there's always going to be professional negligence that's exercised with that patient. But should that professional negligence, like a fall risk assessment, preclude a claim for somebody, it's simple negligence not showing up? Your Honor raised the question of how long was it? How long did she wait? That's a contributory negligence claim. It doesn't require professional testimony about whether she waited.
Are you saying, sorry, I apologize. Are you saying that reasonableness requires the nurse to immediately appear when a call light is pushed?
No, I'm saying it doesn't require expert testimony, and it's something a jury can decide without expert testimony. If this patient is sitting in the room and buzzes the buzzer five times and no one shows up for the time in the testimony, that's something the jury can decide. Even though there was a complaint that had an affidavit on it, and then there was a motion to amend to just state a claim for regular negligence. If that the facts of the case establish regular negligence, and there's all these other things, that claim should be allowed to be pursued. And the one last point, and that is that you're always going to have this argument that we have this plan when this patient comes in, and everything that is done is part of this plan. You know, that's misleading. And the court shouldn't be persuaded by that, because there still may be cases where there's professional negligence, and those claims should be allowed to proceed because they're just professional negligence, and that's this case. It's simple. The complete failure to respond to this call light that caused this poor lady to have to get up and go on. Compression devices are not medical devices. They're like a toothbrush is a medical device. That was the testimony. So these arguments are misleading. We don't.
Hey, Mr. Kent, thank you. We appreciate your arguments. Both counsel, we appreciate your arguments today. And this matter will stand submitted until the next call.
Thank you, Your Honor.